Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
If you want to love a woman, you have to take her erotic nature into account. The erotic nature has only one requirement, and that is that you be fully alive in all your senses, that you observe, that you listen, that you feel, that you taste, that you touch, and that you sense who the other person is at this very moment, not last week, not last year, not last month, but right now, today. The fulfillment of erotic life is based on being seen, fully seen, as who you are today. You don't have to be the most sensitive person on the face of the earth in order to know eroticism. Neither do you have to follow a certain politic, a certain psychology. Neither do you have to be a certain gender or a certain age. It is a practice of being truly alive. To be able to see out of your eyes all the colors. To be able to see out of your eyes all of the things that are before you. To be able to feel both the big and the small things that move inside of you. Thoughts, reflections, emotions, ideas. The erotic life is a life that requires an investment of time to live. Often in relationships, there is a loss of erotic life, and not because people aren't observant, not because people don't have the capacity to be fully alive, but because they're not paying attention, and because they're not taking or making the time to look, truly look at the other one, at the other. They're not taking the time to fully listen. And not just listen to words. You know, there's a sound that the skin makes when the legs are crossed. There's a sound that the hair makes as it moves. But to truly be present to all of these, and no, not necessarily 100 hours every week, not even 24 hours a day, but some of the time, so that you are tied in to the world of Eros, the world of true relationship. So to enter and to live the erotic life means to enter with your eyes open, fully observant. If you want to love a woman, it means you yourself have to be fully alive. A relationship without Eros is a relationship in which people say to one another, well, half a dozen of this and six of the other. Sure is warm for September, isn't it? And they have conversations with one another at a level that is so mundane that the individual's feelings, desires, ideas are entirely left out. The fact of the matter is relationship is not a one-size-fits-all garment. Each relationship is a custom job. Eros and the erotic life cause us to live our life all the way out to the ends of our fingertips, to the ends of our toes, to the ends of our nose, to the very ends of the hairs on our head, to be fully present. So, does eroticism just mean good sex? No, although certainly that's included. But It means fully alive, fully present sexuality. It means fully alive time with the other person. It means fully alive participation in life with the other person. Even as you sit beside one another and simply breathe together. So Eros is the ultimate form of intimacy because it brings every single one of the instruments that you were born with, all your instruments of perception, to the fore, to be used to create actual love between the two of you. So this work, How to Love a Woman, on the erotic life of women and intimacy, is going to begin with an example of recovery of the old words, the old ways, the old metaphors, through the poetry of Sappho, to show what it can be like if one functions, even for moments of time, with one's senses totally open. And from there, we'll move to the story of Skeleton Woman, which is an old Inuit story told to me by Mary Ocalat. And in this story, we will see what happens when one does not want to bring all their awareness and all their senses to a relationship, and what happens when one finally surrenders to that process and becomes fully alive again. We'll look at some of the other parts of intimacy and total aliveness, eroticism, that are often left out of discussions about deep love relationships. We'll look at individual need for solitude, which is paradoxically one of the things that holds a relationship together. We'll look at the 12 traits to look for when choosing a mate, traits that are not based on whether that person can dance or whether they're good looking, but are they, you might say, good looking inside themselves, and can they dance in the underworld? And lastly, we'll look at a final fairy tale for you to bring your own conclusions to bear on this matter of intimacy and eroticism in loving a woman, and that is the story East of the Sun and West of the Moon. So let us proceed. This work, How to Love a Woman, is for anyone who loves a woman, for women who love women, for men who love women, for anyone who loves deeply and well or wants to. It is also for those who have tasted the feminine God and found her love compelling and life-giving. In the multifaceted and exciting and sacred world that rises from fairy tales and mythos, all people, all lovers are taught and are welcome. All are embraced. No one with the intention to love deeply and well is excluded. These ancient teaching stories about love are embedded and still live fully alive in the old stories of the world and sometimes in some of the most ancient poetry. They stand completely and irrefutably separate from the judgments of any single person's ego or personal viewpoint or the viewpoint of the outer culture. In the inner world that has existed since time out of mind, love is not considered a dangerous thing that causes the loss of mind or life, nor is love a force whose parameters should be decided or defended by current fashion or politics. But rather, the desire to love and be loved is considered a spiritual feast, a spiritual practice, a fulfillment of the most deep connection to the mysteries of the creative drive at the heart of the psyche. And so I want to tell you about the work of Sappho. It is said that Sappho lived on the island of Lesbos at Mytilene, and that she came from one of the upper-class families. Her father, they say, was named Scamandronymus, and Cleus was her mother's name. It is said that Sappho was exiled, along with hundreds of others, but no one says exactly for what purpose, but so many records have been lost over all these aeons. Some say that a manuscript of her work survived up to the early centuries A.D. and then was destroyed by the conquering nations and various religions that they brought with them. So all that was left was a few brittle paper fragments. And though many readers of the pitiful fragments of her work say that she was, in the way that many male scholars have more or less categorized all women's writings for many millennia, that she was concerned with household and personal relationships in her writing, and that these concerns make up the substance of her work. Well, while that may be true and honorable, when I read her work, I was taken with its passion in the same vein as that of the ecstatic poets Rumi and Mirabai and Kabir from the Far East, who were writing of love because they were in love with God. And they called their God beloved and related to their God as marriage partner. The more I read the many translations of Sappho's work, the more I was convinced that her work was prayers, profound love prayers, profound erotic love prayers to the female goddess. In other words, a profound erotic love for the feminine, written in the same sacred tones that mystics have used since time out of mind to worship any beneficent and bountiful god. The loss of this kind of poetry by a woman who not only loved women, but also loved the feminine god, poetry to the erotic feminine, not only destroys the universe of knowledge about the feminine and about real women and about how they work and play in love and what they are made of, but it also destroys the instructions for love of the erotic feminine god and instructions and guidance about the nature of human women also and how to love them well and long. So the reclamation of Sappho's work as erotic instruction, an erotic viewpoint, a spiritual practice, is very useful. And as we live in a society that sometimes values properness and sanction and places them as more important than lifelong love, it is even more significant that we bring this work back to life. So because I'm a poet and I have an inner hearing for poetic voice, and because I also have many years of training and study in archetypal pattern as a psychoanalyst, I took the fragments of Sappho's poems, and according to feeling and knowing the templates of archetypal pattern, I reconstructed the missing parts, similar to the manner in which the conservator of bones in a museum begins with the tiny shards of the crown and the occipital ridge of the skull and places them upon an armature, and by following the forms that exist, recreates the entire shape. That is what poetry is concerned with, a lyrical shape. Now, some may not like that I've done this. They may call it a liberty to reconstruct lost work. And I say, too bad. The work and the message is too important to be allowed to remain just scraps. So here, for the first time, is a fulsome, non-fragmented gathering of Sappho's lyrical and ecstatic work on the erotic love of the feminine. And standing behind Sappho's work are aeons of love of the female god and aeons of love of the feminine, and therefore instruction to us of eons and eons of why and wherefore and how to love a woman. Listen. Thank you. the wind of love enters through my window. Oh, Aphrodite, you come to me at night when I'm alone, with no one to know you through, with no one to touch so I can hear you moan. Come back tomorrow, can't you? Come back when I have within my range of touch the one I love, and like a mountain wind, my love chopping, chopping, chopping at the hardwood of my being, making it into heartwood once again. I begin lovemaking by blowing my breath upon you. Do you know that you can write love words upon a lover's back with your tongue? I write all over your body the things I want and the things I know you need. It's such a good beginning, but I promise you, only a beginning. There will be a later that goes on and on and on. So come, my holy underwater shell, that drum between your legs, become a poem. Now speak to me with your tiny tongue, make the music that we both love. The stars are little beauty fires. They glow, but they are just tiny babies next to the splendor of the moon. Anyone who is a lover can see how the moon in her long gown shakes a silver powder all around her body and then sets it afire. And then how she burns for her lover with such a silvery fire all night long, turning first this way and that in the sky, spinning ever so slowly before the eyes that watch her, loving the eyes that watch her, wanting the eyes to watch her, turning slowly, taking all night long in order to show, and slowly, her every treasure. The earth is in flower at last after that winter of brown and gray. Now, Aphrodite puts out her embroidery, the scenes that teach lovers how it all goes. Look, they're in the corner of the cloth where it's night. There's a lover with dark red skin and green hair who covers another squirming, wiggling body that laughs, that of a dark ochre-colored woman. One says to the other, could the moon finger or fondle or touch you right here? The woman who will not be tamed come to our doors, and they leave the faintest smell of violets behind. It makes a body want to gather a woman that smells that way, pick her like a flower, even crush her in a rough embrace to force more of this divine scent from her. What are you doing, wasting your time walking around in the streets looking at women? Take the one you have and tangle in the sheets all night, till even the nightingales, who are not amazed at anything that humans do, are once again amazed. All the night long, believe me when I say, I have prayed that our time with all these little breaths in between us would last twice as long. In the crooks of your body, I find my religion. Together we float upward toward the goddess thighs and drink from her lap. Here is my prayer. Please, Aphrodite, give me 3 more days before morning. And Eros, loosener of the iron bands that hold in reluctant thighs. Well, Eros has decided that she never calls his name to come untie her bows or undo the clasps that women's clothes are always held with, and because she does not call to be unbound, she's hard to find. For lack of passion makes us small. Brightness in this darkness. You. At your center, I am rowing toward that pale light. The fates direct me to the resting place, the earth that lies in her body. We are sailors, and the great gales blow over our bodies, and we are bucking throats, and we are thrashing knees, and we are aiming for the place, the place, the place to sail into the deepest port. Storms in your arms and storms in your thighs. The sky is flowing, is streaming behind my closed eyes. Awash, at last, in each other's arms. Calm now, the storm. I rest at last on the shore of your body.
Doesn't it seem like it would be wonderful if we could be held in the arms of the deeply sexual erotic all the time? We just ride wave after wave after wave of feeling and be connected to the shining light at the center of the psyche with another person. It would seem like we would never be lonely ever again. And yet, there are other parts to love that make it complete. It cannot be one-dimensional. And there's another form of eroticism that has to do with descent and death. It has to do with being fully alive, fully awake. But instead of the light of the pleasure center and all that that brings to us in love, instead, we go down into the dark, and it is in the dark that we find the lower cycle of loving a woman. To love means one has to go through many parts of a cycle, an incubation, a birth, a rising energy, reaching to a zenith, and then the beginning of an entropy and a decline in feeling and understanding and awareness, and a descent and a darkening, and finally a death, followed again by an incubation, which culminates again in a rebirth and a rising energy once again in the relationship. So even though I myself personally have 3 favorite blues songs, I'm a Fugitive for Love, Baby, and 60 Minute Man, and 4 Alarm Lover. Even so, I know that only part of love can be spent in that part of the city, that there are other sections that have to be brought together in order to call love something all of one piece, something that is strong and vital and enduring. For those who want to love a woman, becoming a master at the ability to rise and fall in those cycles is just as important as the ability to rise and fall in lovemaking. One of the ways that I like to look at human life, instinctual life,
is by looking at wildlife. Wolves, eagles, bears, these are some of my favorites, wolves in particular, and wolves are really good at relationship. Anybody who's ever observed them for any length of time sees how deeply they bond with one another. Often they are lifelong mates. And even though they clash, or there's dissension, or they show each other their teeth, in the end, there's reconciliation. Even though they go through harsh winters together, you know, the wolves are usually the ones who, at least in the north, who are a little left out when the snows become high and they cannot hunt for the very small game or for the vegetation that's so abundant in the springtime. And the caribou and sometimes the moose and the elk become their snow plows for them. And so that's why they follow those larger creatures, often trying to pick off one of the old or the sick. And so even though they go through difficult winters and sometimes famines together, they stay together. There's something innate in that staying together that has to do with the ability to ride the cycles of feast and famine. I remember a long time ago when I first came into the Southwest and I was living in northern New Mexico. I remember someone telling me this old saying, one day it's the chicken and the next day it's the feathers. And what they meant was that sometimes things are fat and sometimes things are very spare. But we just go along, one follows the other. And in the desire to love another person, the ability to ride that cycle is critical. So if we were to use archetypal terms to describe what determines the strong bonds among wolves or humans, we might surmise that the integrity of relationship is based on the ability to submit to and to ride with some grace that ancient life-death-life nature, that cycle of animation and development and then decline and death that is always followed by reanimation. Now, as you know, some people would like to keep a relationship in the animation stage forever. They would like it to be at the zenith. They would like it to be the highest high. They would like to have all their nerves standing on end forever. Not possible. Not possible for two reasons. One is, to be in that condition for a long time, in many ways, is like taking drugs. Potent ones. So that pretty soon, a person who's in the condition of constant arousal looks like a person whose brain is fried. And I know some people would say, that's fine with me. It's okay with me if my brain is fried. But not really, because what it does is it robs the person of something deeper, and that is the development of the ability to ride those cycles. Because the cycles not only go through love relationships, and very profoundly there, but they also go throughout one's entire life. And without the ability to ride through the land of the dead, the person is never fully mature, and their work, their output, is never fully mature, and their ability to love is never whole. So, there is no way around it. As we shall see, one must sleep with Lady Death. Skeleton Woman is a hunting story about love. It's a story from far north, from the Inuit. It's also told by the Aleuts. I learned it from Mary Ukulat, who was the cook at a fishing camp when I was a child. In stories from the north, love is not a romantic tryst between two lovers. It does not start with candlelight, although maybe sometimes by moonlight. But stories from the circumpolar regions usually describe love as a union of two beings whose strength together enables one or both
to enter into communication with the soul world, and to participate in fate as a dance with life and death. Although there are many joke stories among the Inuits and the Aleuts that have to do with relationship, there are also very serious stories. Skeleton Woman is one of these. To understand this story, we have to see that there, in one of the harshest environs and one of the most stressed hunting cultures in the world, love does not mean a flirtation or a pursuit for ego pleasure alone, but a visible and viable bond composed of the psychic sinew of endurance, a union that prevails through bounty and austerity, and through the most complicated and the most simple days and nights. The union of two beings is seen as angakak, magic in itself, as a relationship through which the powers that be become known to both individuals. But there are requirements for this kind of union. It's not something that happens over the weekend. In order to create this enduring kind of love, one invites a third partner to the union. The third partner is not the woman or the man of fantasy, but is a real woman, a skeleton woman. She is also called Lady Death, and as such, she is the life and death and life nature in one of her many guises. In this form, Lady Death is not a disease and not a decline, but she is a deity. And in relationships, she has the role of the oracle, who knows when it is time for things to live and when it is time for things to die. And as such, she is the wildest aspect of relationship, the one of whom men are most terrified, and often women as well. For when faith in the transformative has been lost, as it often is in our culture, the natural cycles of increase and attrition and increase again are feared as well. People don't believe when something goes into decline that it will come back again. They have lost the vision of it. They have lost their faith in it. In some ways, if you could imagine a culture filled with people who imagine and are fearful every night that the sun will never rise again, that's the equivalent that we have in our culture with regard to lifelong relationship. So to create an enduring love, a skeleton woman must be admitted to our relationships and be embraced by both lovers. So here, in this old Inuit story, are the psychic stages of mastery for that embrace. Up in the north, during a time when nothing moved, in a winter that was hunger, hunger, and more hunger, people told of a woman who had done something of which her father disapproved, although no one any longer remembered what it really was. But they said her father had routed her from the house and dragged her to the cliffs and thrown her over and into the sea. And that there, as she sank down through the water, the fish ate her flesh away and plucked out her eyes. And that she drifted down and down and down to the bottom of the sea, where she lay, her skeleton turning over and over in the currents. And one day, a fisherman came fishing. Well, in truth, many came to this bay once, but this fisherman had drifted far from his home place, and he did not know that the local fisherman stayed away from this bay, saying that indeed it was haunted. And the fisherman's bone hook drifted down through the water, and down and down and down, and caught, of all places, in the bones of skeleton woman's rib cage. And the fisherman thought, "Whew, now I've really got a big one. Now I really have one." And in his mind, he was thinking of how many people this great fish would feed, and how long it would last, and how long he might be free from the chore of hunting. And as he struggled with this great weight on the end of the hook, the sea was stirred to a thrashing froth, and his kayak bucked and shook, for she, who was beneath, struggled to disentangle herself. And the more she struggled, the more she tangled in the line. And no matter what she did, she was inexorably dragged upward, tugged up by the bones of her very own ribs. While the hunter had turned to scoop up his net to catch this great prize, so he did not see her bald head rise above the waves, and he did not see the crustaceans on her old ivory teeth. And so when he turned back with his net, her entire body, such as it was, had come to the surface and was hanging from the tip of his kayak with her long front teeth. "Ah!" cried the man, and his heart fell into his knees, and his eyes hid in terror on the back of his head, and his ears turned blazing bright red. "Ah!" he screamed, and he knocked her off the prow with his oar and began paddling like a demon toward the shoreline. And not realizing she was tangled in his line, he was frightened all the more, for she appeared to stand up on her toes while chasing him all the way to the shore. And no matter which way he zigged his kayak, she stayed right behind, and her breath rolled over the water in clouds of steam, and her arms flailed out as though to snatch him down into the depths. "Ah!" he wailed as he ran aground. In one leap, he was out of his kayak, clutching his fishing stick and running, and the coral-white corpse of skeleton woman still snagged in the fishing line, bumpity-bumped right behind him. Over the rocks he ran, and she followed. And over the frozen tundra he ran, and she kept right up. And over the meat laid out to dry he ran, cracking it to pieces as his mukluks bore down. And throughout it all she kept right up. In fact, she grabbed some of the frozen fish as she was dragged behind, and this she began to eat, for she had not gorged in a long, long time. And finally the man reached his snow house and dove right into the tunnel, and on hands and knees he scrabbled his way into the interior. And panting and sobbing, he lay there in the dark, his heart a drum, a mighty drum. "Oh, safe at last, oh, safe at last, oh, thank God, yes, thank the gods, Raven, yes, thank Raven, yes, and bountiful Sedna, oh, thank you, safe at last." Imagine when he lit his whale oil lamp, there she, it, lay in a tumble upon his snow floor, one heel over her shoulder and one knee inside her rib cage and one foot over her elbow. And he could not say later what it was. Perhaps the firelight softened her features, or the fact that he was a lonely man. But a feeling of some kindness came into his breathing, and slowly he reached out his grimy hands, and using words softly, like a mother to child, he began to untangle her from the fishing line. "Oh, na, 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 na." First he untangled the toes, and then the ankles. "Oh, na, 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 na." On and on he worked into the night, until dressing her in furs to keep her warm, skeleton woman's bones were all in the order a human's should be. "Na, na, na, na. Na, 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 na." He felt into his leather cuffs for his flint and used some of his hair to light a little more fire, and he gazed at her from time to time as he oiled the precious wood of his fishing stick, and he rewound his gut line. And she, in the furs, uttered not a word. She did not dare. lest this hunter take her out and throw her down to the rocks and break her bones to pieces utterly. As soon the man became drowsy, the heat made little prickles in his eyes, and he slid down under his sleeping skins, and soon he was dreaming. And sometimes, as humans sleep, you know, a tear escapes from the dreamer's eye, and we never know what sort of dream causes this, but we know that it is a dream of sadness, or else longing. And this is what happened to the fisherman. The skeleton woman saw the tear glisten in the firelight, trembling there in the hollow of his eye, and she became suddenly so thirsty. And so she tinkled and clanked and crawled over to the sleeping man and put her mouth to his tear. A single tear was like a river, and she drank and drank and drank and drank until her many years long thirst was slaked. And then she lay beside him. And at the collarbone, she reached inside the sleeping man and took out his heart, the mighty drum. And she sat up and banged on both sides of it. Bum bum. Bum bum. And as she drummed, she began to sing out, "Fly, yes, fly, flesh." And the more she sang, the more her body filled out with flesh. The flesh. And she sang for hair, and for good eyes, and for nice fat hands. And she sang the divide between her legs. And she sang for breasts long enough to wrap for warmth, and all the things a woman needs. And when she was all done, she also sang the sleeping man's clothes off, and crept into bed with him, skin against skin. And oh, what it was like to have flesh once more. Oh, what it was like to feel the warmth of another. And she returned the great drum, his heart, to his body. And that is how they awakened, wrapped one around the other, tangled from their night. In another way now, a good way, a lasting way. And the people who cannot remember how she came to her first ill fortune say that she and the fisherman went away, and that they were consistently well fed by the creatures that she had known and loved all of her life underwater. And the people say that this is true, and that is all they know. So here we have it. In order for humans to live and give loyalty in this most fit manner, in the way that's most wise and most preserving and most feeling, one has to go up against the very thing that one fears the most. No way around it. Everyone has to sleep with Lady Death. However, as you might imagine, inability to face and untangle the skeleton woman is what causes many love relationships to falter and sometimes to fail. Because to love, one must not only have feeling and great heart, an affection, an arousal, To love one must not only be strong, but wise. And strength comes from the spirit, but wisdom comes from the skeleton woman, because she knows how to die and how to come back to life again. She knows how to restore herself. And therefore, the energy in relationship. As we can see in this tale, if one wishes to be fed for life, one must face and develop a relationship with the life-death-life nature. When we have that, we're no longer bumbling along fishing for fantasies, but we're made wise about the necessary deaths and the eventual startling births that create true relationship. When we have intercourse, so to speak, with the skeleton woman, we learn that passion is not something to go get, but rather something that is generated in cycles and given out, ebbing and flowing. Skeleton woman demonstrates that a shared living together through all increase and decrease and through all endings and beginnings is what creates the unparalleled love. And what is that, you say? It is the most difficult love, but the one that is most deep, most enduring, the love of devotion. This story is a really good metaphor for the problem of modern love, the fear of the life-death-life nature. Of course, the death aspect in particular, almost no one seems to be too afraid of life. In fact, sometimes I laugh to myself when I hear someone say, I'm afraid to do that really wonderful, interesting thing. Most often people aren't afraid of doing the interesting thing. People are afraid the interesting thing won't last, and they'll have to go through a death. And that's what they fear. In so much of Western culture, the original character of the death nature has been covered over. Various religions have put their dogmas and doctrines on it until it is split off from the other half, which is life. Just simply in terms of what we see happening when a person is ill, how much of the establishment is aimed toward keeping the bones of that person alive, no matter what else is going on with the body or with the mind or the spirit, and that literally hundreds of thousands of dollars will be spent to keep the bones alive long after the spirit is already knocking and rattling to get out. And that's because the life and death nature are split apart from one another. In our culture, people tend to see death as ending rather than as continuation. And furthermore, people think of death as something that happens when something is sick or diseased, when in fact, death is part of the natural cycle of everything that lives, everything that has energy, everything that has movement to it. Let me tell you about Tetzadi. Tetzadi is a goddess in Mexico, and she carries with her a copper bowl, and turned one way against her chest. The bowl is the breast, and milk flows unendingly. And turned another way against her belly. The bowl is the womb, and it incubates all new life. And turned another way, held straight up in one's arms, Tetzadi's bowl becomes the grave. And she is the life mother, and she is the death mother. And it is believed that Tetzadi comes when a person is dying, and she comes with her big copper bowl. And as the life force leaves the body, she picks up the person and puts them in her big copper bowl. And she swirls them around and swirls them around in the bowl. And as she does, they become smaller and smaller. And she swirls some more and some more. And they become even smaller yet until finally they're so tiny they can hardly be seen. And they're just like a little tiny dot of blackness, like a little tiny seed. And then it said, the Tasari flies out into the sky at night, and she looks for a woman who has just made love. And she picks the little tiny dark seed up out of her copper bowl. And ding, she drops it into the womb of a woman who has just made love. So Tasari is another goddess, another image that keeps alive the concept of the life-death-life nature in its wholeness, in its entirety. And in that cycle is immense energy, the energy of constant creation, as is so in all relationships. Even when people become so busy that they don't even see what each other looks like, and, you know, people could paint their hair green and show up for breakfast that way one morning, and their mate might not notice that anything is different. Even when people are preoccupied, the life, death, life nature continues regardless. And what often happens is that when people are preoccupied, guess when they wake up? Not in the exaltation cycle, not in the zenith, but in the decline. And I go, whew. And then they have to realize that they've been using the zenith and the arousal of the relationship, that part of the relationship, to actually continue to be more preoccupied with the outer world and their tasks that they've committed themselves to in the outer world instead of paying attention to the relationship. And so they're not exactly yet mastering the riding of that cycle. They're sort of riding the zenith part, but they would like to get off once it reaches past that point until it comes back into the quickening and the arousal again. However, the real bones of relationship are in the entire cycle, not just in one side. In a relationship that is solid in other ways, you can recognize the decline that comes into the relationship on a regular basis by the fact that the parties have a sensation of deadness, of growing numbness, not just toward themselves, but also toward one another. It isn't that they don't care for one another, and it isn't that they don't like one another. It has to do with a lack or a loss of energy. If you could imagine that the love relationship has a headwaters and tributaries and then other streams and even creeks that come out of that, suddenly something at the headwaters slows down. It's not as much water. And so some of the tributaries dry up. And there's just not as much moisture in the relationship. It's frail, it's thin. People go to bed early. Don't talk to each other as much as they used to. People can't find as much that's interesting. People feel bored. These are all signs that the relationship is in the entropy part of the cycle and soon will be entering an incubation period where things will be developing and quickening and growing but will not necessarily have burst forth onto the surface again. It's during this time of entropy that sometimes people question, why am I with this person? Am I in the right place at the right time with the right person? Is this marriage working? Is this what the relationship's going to be like for the rest of my life? Those are the things that occur to people during this time. And after people have gone through this cycle at least once consciously, they never worry about that ever again. Because they know that this is the natural cycle, the instinctive nature of love to go through inclines and declines. So rather than seeing the archetypes of death and life as opposites, they have to be held together as the left and the right side of a single thought. And while it's true that within a single love relationship there are many endings, somehow and somewhere in the delicate layers of the being that is created when two people love one another, there is both a heart and breath. And when one side of the heart empties, the other fills. And when one breath runs out, another begins. And sometimes the cycles in relationship can be just about that quick. One moment, you're not quite sure who this person is that you're waking up beside. And in the very next moment, you can be filled and flooded with emotion and caring toward them. If one believes that the life-death life force has no stanza beyond death, then it's no wonder that some humans are frightened of commitment. I mean, it's almost like the malaise of the 20th century. Well, I'm sorry, I can't go any further in this relationship because, choose one, A, B, or C, because it's not right, because I feel tied down, because I need my space. Those are the most popular sayings. They've almost, you might say, they're archetypes in and of themselves because they're repetitious and they're not very original. However, people are often terrified in our culture to go through even one ending. And sometimes I think this comes as a result by being surrounded by so much war, one way or another. War in the corporate world. War with real ammunition and real guns. War that goes on within the family structure. War that goes on between the genders. War that goes on between races and in class battles. But regardless of the pressures that we feel upon us, some people, instead of mastering the fear, continue with the fear because they sense that in order to enter relationship, they have to meet Lady Death, one of the most horrifying figures who's personified by the gray ladies in Greek mythology, by the fates, by the banshee, by Durga, the dark goddess, by Kali, by all the life-death goddesses that exist in the world. And the last thing a person who's in love sometimes wants to do is to wake up next to Lady Death. However, it's the only hope for the relationship. So when we forget that Lady Death is loving and that life will be renewed through her, we have a fear of saying, I will be here, I will be with you, I will be with you for as long as I live. Ooh, for some people that sends a shudder all the way down their spine. But it should not, in fact, quite the opposite. To be without the bounty and the opportunity of lifelong relationship, that's what should send a shudder down the spine.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.